This is Radio Boston. I'm Anthony Brooks.
And I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
We find, as we look into the matter, that ERA won't give women anything which they haven't already got or have a way of getting. But on the other hand, it will take away from women some of the most important rights and benefits and exemptions we now have.
That was archival tape of Phyllis Schlafly, one of the most prominent conservative opponents of the Equal Rights Amendment, which she helped defeat in 1982.
A few years later, a young woman named Suzanne Venker was sitting in a class at Boston University. She remembers a professor talking about Schlafly in tones that were neither positive nor polite. Venker sank down in her chair.
Because, though her classmates did not know it, Venker is Phyllis Schlafly's niece. Quote, Phyllis knew feminism was a farce long before other folks wised up, Venker writes.
Well, Venker is no longer hiding the fact that Schlafly is family. In fact, she and her aunt have co-authored a new book called The Flip Side of Feminism, What Conservative Women Know and Men Can't Say.
It is a fiery, impassioned, and controversial attack on feminism, a movement that Venker claims is, quote, the single worst thing that has happened to American women. It did not liberate them at all. So what do you make of that statement, and what do you make of this new assessment on feminism in America? We want your thoughts on this. You can give us a call at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. But first, I would like to welcome to WBUR Suzanne Venker. She is joining us from the studios of KWMU in St. Louis. Suzanne Venker, welcome to Radio Boston.
Thanks for having me.
It's truly great to have you. And unfortunately, we couldn't have your aunt Phyllis Schlafly on, but the book was quite an adventure to read, and so I'm looking forward to speaking with you about it. But why don't I just start by asking you to tell us a little bit more about your story, that you grew up in Missouri, but you were a student at Boston University, and yet when you came to BU, you said you started to feel alone and isolated. And why is that?
Well, I wouldn't say isolated, but I quickly learned that I was going from one area of the country, Midwest, to another, the East Coast, and that those two, that there's a big chasm between those two. That my contemporaries at that time mostly came from the tri-state area. Coming from St. Louis was a little unusual for a Boston University student, and it just sort of. Over time, I realized that our values just differed. Now, the only time it became really more apparent, I guess, and the examples that I give there in the introduction to Flipside, mm-hmm. is that my roommates would, I remember at one point, going to the to Washington, D.C. for a pro-choice march, and I didn't go. And I think that was sort of the first tip off that maybe there was a difference there. And then I was there during the Michael Dukakis and George Bush Sr. Election, and we were on opposite sides there as well. So now that's just politics. The more interesting aspect of it was the heated discussions we would have.
Yeah, I mean, you write that you realized, you say that your classmates were, quote, well-schooled by their feminist parents, baby boomer parents, mm-hmm. and that is not an experience that you shared growing up.
That is correct. Another thing that separated me from my contemporaries, not just at Boston University, but also as a high schooler, is that my parents were a tad bit older than others, about good 10 to 15 years older than my friends' parents. And because of that, they came from the greatest generation, just a very different generation from the baby boomers. And so the values that I was raised with were very different from the values that a lot of the people I knew were raised with. And that it was always there. It was just always evident.
Mm-hmm. Well, so take us then now into the present. You've written this new book, The Flip Side of Feminism, What Conservative Women Know and Men Can't Say. And, as I mentioned, you do have a very searing critique of feminism. You have mm-hmm. your book there with you in the studio?
I do.
And there's an excerpt of it that you'd like to read. Can you go ahead and read that for us?
Yes, this is from the conclusion, actually, that's called A New Roadmap for Women. And it's underneath a section that starts, Admitting the Problem is Half the Battle. And I write here, recognizing that feminism failed in its mission, that it is based on faulty assumptions and arguments, and that it drives a wedge between men and women, and even among women, is the first step to recovery. And then I use an example right after that from several feminists who are sort of recovering feminists, if you will, and they tell their story. And this particular example is from Rebecca Walker, who is the daughter of Alice Walker, who wrote The Color Purple. And I thought her story was most poignant. She writes, "As a child, I grew up believing that children are millstones around your neck, and the idea that motherhood can make you happy is a complete fairy tale. When I hit my 20s, I could feel my biological clock ticking, but I felt if I listened to it, I would be betraying my mother and all she had taught me. In fact, having a child has been the most rewarding experience of my life. My only regret is that I discovered the joys of motherhood so late. I have been trying for a second child, but so far with no luck. Feminism has betrayed an entire generation of women into childlessness. But far from taking responsibility for this, the leaders of the women's movement close ranks against anyone who dares to question them, as I have learned to my cost. I believe feminism is an experiment, and all experiments need to be assessed on their results. Then, when you see that huge mistakes have been paid, you need to make alterations."
So that's you quoting Rebecca Walker, daughter of Alice Walker. But Suzanne Venker, I mean, in your words, what do you see is the problem with feminism? Why do you call it the worst thing ever to happen to American women?
Yeah, and I use that example because that is such an important story, and it's not just her story. It's so many people's story. And what we're really left with when it comes to feminism is not just that issue that she's referring to with struggle having children later in life, but also this notion that women today owe feminists for everything. Now, you might have noticed when this article was published in BU Today a week ago, and there were so many comments, negative comments, of course, from people on campus. The overwhelming theme in those comments was something to the effect of, how do Suzanne and Phyllis, for that matter, think they are able to get published in the first place? Or how is it that they can disparage a movement that is what allowed them to get college degrees and become authors? Now, that was very telling because that is exactly the message that young people are getting about feminism, that we as women today owe feminists for those things. But in fact, we do not. And if we did, I mean, if that were the case, then how is it that my grandmother in 1920 had a college degree? How is it that my mother, who's now 80, has a master's degree and went into the male-dominated field of she was a stockbroker. During the 50s, before the 60s movement got off the ground. So there is a lot of information in this book that is contrary to the information that young ladies and men are being taught.
So, listeners, what do you think when you hear what Suzanne Venker has to say? Do you agree with her and think that feminism is the worst thing to happen to American women, or maybe the best thing? And I wonder, if you consider yourself conservative, does Suzanne Venker represent you, or are you incensed by what you're hearing? And I really would like to hear from young women as well. You know, when you hear the battle cries from conservatives or liberals, pro or anti-feminists, do those arguments even have meaning to you today? You can always join us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. You know, Suzanne, I read the examples from your own family very carefully, and, you know, it's full of very accomplished women, as you say, throughout the generations. But I also, you know, I presume that no matter what a person's perspective is, you can find individual examples of success and say, here's the reason why feminism has nothing to do with it, or someone on the opposite end might say, here's the reason why feminism has everything to do with it. But your critique even goes deeper than that. I mean, you seem to be saying that feminism almost has some kind of mind control over American women, making them think that they need to live their lives in a certain way. And why is that? Why do you think that it's so all-pervasive through American society?
There is a chasm in America, essentially, between the powerful and the not-so-powerful. I'll call them everyday Americans. We know from the research that everyday Americans are largely a right-of-center bunch. We also know that those in the media are largely not a right-of-center bunch. And because of that, the views on all areas of our lives, whether it's education, sex, work, motherhood, you name it, all those important aspects of life are getting filtered through a left-wing lens.
Well, except that there's a lot of very powerful, I mean, Rush Limbaugh has huge numbers of listeners that, you know, put, I'll even admit
Rush
it, our own listeners, you know, our own listener numbers in in a shadow. So there's, I think you're identifying parts of the media here.
Well, what I'm referring to specifically, what we call the feminist elite. And the feminist elite they reside in three areas: academia, as evidenced by the responses from the article at Boston University last week, and in Hollywood and in the media. And most people, especially young people, are exposed on a routine basis to these women, first in college, then in the media via television, magazines, and in Hollywood. So the messages that they're getting are consistently coming from this one place. And that message conflicts with what I believe will lead them to a happy place and will go along with the value system that they have for themselves. And they need a voice. And that's really where Flipside comes in. You know, I got several emails as a result of that article at BU from students at BU who thanked me profusely because they feel like they have nowhere to go. That's what I'm all about. I am for those people who don't have a voice.
And, you know, what was interesting to me in the book is that, you know, you spend quite a bit of time really, you know, going after, for example, Gloria Steinem, Betty Friedan, the biggest names in what's popularly known as second wave feminism. And a lot of your arguments against them, to be honest, they sort of struck me as you going after an antiquated notion of feminism, like one that's sort of frozen in amber from the 60s and 70s, and that maybe a lot of women, and maybe it's not very many anymore, but those women who think about feminism today don't actually subscribe to those same notions from, you know, the 60s and 70s, and you're attacking something that doesn't really exist anymore.
Well, can you give me an example of what you mean?
Well, you know, when you say that, I have a quote here, you say that, "For if I wasn't a feminist," well, you're describing what people who are feminists today think. You say, "For if I wasn't a feminist, downgrading the role of wife and mother and planning an exciting career to liberate me from the home, well, then I must be conservative." And it was this, you know, when you say, it seems like you're saying that people, feminists still think that liberation means being free from men, free from the home, and, you know, free from the shackles that society has put on them. And I wonder if more women today don't see it as liberation, but just as a natural part of the totality of what they want to experience in their lives.
Well, that would be fine because I would define that the same way myself. Totality of what I want to experience. There's a lot of things I want to do in my life, and I explain in the book that women. It's a very positive book that women can have it all if they sequence their lives. But if that were true, that it wasn't. If what you said was true, then why is it that women in college, many women in college, who aspire to have marriage and motherhood at the center of their lives, feel that they cannot say that out loud without being attacked, or maybe not attacked, but looked at funny? It is not PC to talk about getting married and having babies when you're in college. That is a fact. And the reality of that does stem from something, and it stems from feminism, because feminism at its outset in the 1960s was about demeaning motherhood. Now, we can go back and forth on this all day long, but it's in the book very clearly how it all began, and all the research and the backup for that research is there. So it's sort of like it's snowballed. That's kind of what I'm getting at. That anything that starts there is going to eventually, you know, you say something often enough over and over and over again, and it just becomes part of the culture. And there's so many people that today, they don't think of themselves as feminists. They don't even use that term. But their lives have been a direct result of the feminist culture and the influence of feminism on their life, often without even knowing it.
We have a lot of people who want to join this conversation. Suzanne, I'm speaking with Suzanne Venker. She is the co-author of The Flip Side of Feminism. We had a comment on our Facebook page. Alexander Thompson wrote, In the 1990s, a very influential group of feminists convinced the woman I loved that I was the source of all her woe and worry. She decided with their encouragement to leave me, break my heart, and has been fairly miserable ever since. Up with women never has meant down with men. Let's take a call also from Alston. Kimberly's on the line. You're on the air, Kimberly.
Thanks for taking my call. I just wanted to make a quick comment that I don't ever see feminism as one single battle that either was won or lost, but as an ongoing struggle for liberation, just as a civil rights movement.
Kimberly, it sounds like we've lost you. I'm sorry about that, but, you know, cell phones are what they are. Let's take another call from Wilmington. Betty is on the line. Welcome to Radio Boston, Betty.
Hi. Well, thank you for taking my call. My problem with the conversation today is allowing somebody to define what feminism is. Starting in the 1950s, for me, feminism goes back to when women fought for the right to vote. And to freeze it at one time, very often the leaders of a movement need to be extreme because they're taking positions that are so contrary to what's accepted by society. And then movements evolve. I'm in my 50s. For me, feminism has never been anti-family. I've always wanted a family. I've always wanted children. Most of the women I know around me, and I'm college educated with a master's degree, wanted family and wanted children and considered themselves feminists. I take exception to feminism being defined by someone else for me.
Betty, thanks for your call. Suzanne, your response to that.
I'm so glad she brought that up. You know, feminism absolutely means different things to different people. And one of the things that we talk about on Flipside is that today feminism is discussed in three parts, essentially. First wave, second wave, and third wave. The first wave being the suffragette movement of the 19th century, then the second wave being the Betty Friedan 1960s period, and then the third wave being today. I think the most outspoken feminist today is Jessica Valenti, and she has a organization or website called Feministing, and they represent the third wave feminists. And she gave the definition, a working definition for feminism just several months ago in the Washington Post. She said feminism is, quote, a structural analysis of a world that oppresses women, an ideology based on the notion that patriarchy exists and that it needs to end. So when I go to the definition for feminism, I go right to the source, to the feminist. I mean, they should know what their own organization,
well, yeah, one
or movement
source
is. So, well, one source, but it's the current, that certainly that represents third wave, and that goes hand in hand with second wave. However, it does not go hand in hand with first wave. So there is no real comparison between the suffragette movement and the feminist movement in the 1960s. The feminists in the 1960s just piggybacked off of that earlier movement that virtually every sane person would agree with in terms of the right to vote, and called that women's rights and said that they were continuing forth with that initial movement. But in fact, the early feminists, if you want to call them that, the suffragettes, were not pro-choice and were very family-oriented women. So those two agendas are very different.
Let's take another call. Jimmy is calling from Lowell. Welcome to Radio Boston, Jimmy.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. It's a really interesting conversation. I think I'm well aware of this just right now in my life because my wife is pregnant and I have a two-year-old, and she's a teacher. She's also she works full-time. And I think that for me and for her, I would say, speaking for her, you know, it's about having the choices and being able to make those choices of what type of life you're going to lead. And I guess that's how we would define what feminism is, you know, without having a set definition. And I guess my question would be, you know, if you're not allowed to make those choices and have equal rights to make those decisions, at what point, you know, when are we going back to the point where we're in a situation that's happening in some other countries where women are in a very, very different position and they're not equal to men and they're not given the same rights? I'm just curious where that, it's a spectrum, and I'm curious where she sees that as far as being, you know, the dividing line.
We've got it, Jimmy. Thanks so much. Suzanne, your thoughts?
Yeah, the distinction there is wonderful. I think that focusing on oppression for women in third world countries or worldwide is a fantastic place for feminists to focus their attention. Hillary Clinton right now has taken on an assignment for that very thing. And I think that the focus should be over there as opposed to here, because the problem is comparing American women to women in other countries and suggesting that we are all sort of equally oppressed, and that's kind of, you know, that there's still more work to be done here, as though we are not fully finished with the movement, when I'm saying essentially we are. Focus on the real oppression. That's great.
Suzanne, let me ask you, in the book you write out what you believe the three tenets of feminism are. You cite them as: number one, feminists are imprisoned by their negative view of women and their place in the world around them. Number two, all of the injustices perpetuated on women through the centuries, the most oppressive on women is that women must have babies and men do not. And the third one, there's no difference between males and females other than their sex organs. That's what you say feminists believe today, and I've tried to, you know, convince other Americans believing. And then I read in the end of your book, you know, here are what you call are the non-negotiables in terms of the solutions to the problem that you see. You say, one, casual sex is a dead-end street. Two, marriage is the ultimate goal and divorce should not be assumed to be an option. And three, children need, deserve, and want to be raised by their own parents. Now, I'm not saying that anyone should be objecting to them or on either side, but what struck me is that those are as non-negotiable in their tone as you say feminists are in their tone. So, you know,
mine are good.
Well, 21st century life.
Mine makes sense.
In 21st
mine
century life, doesn't life
most people.
Doesn't life fall somewhere in between? And I think a lot of young women who I'm sure you've spoken to, who we've spoken to on this show, who are listening right now, their lives are somewhere in between, and what they want isn't so much, you know, the black and white old school battles of the 60s and 70s. They want guidance that understands the nuances that they have to live through and experience.
I agree. And I think that Flip Side does that. I think that it absolutely, you call it black and white, but those three non-negotiables in the end aren't designed to be viewed as black and white. They're designed to give assistance, really, help in planning your life in a way that will ultimately bring you, or I should say allow you to have it all in a way that the current message that you get from the culture doesn't allow. And so I'm saying essentially, you know, ignore the culture in the way they're telling you to do things. If you do it this way, you have a better chance to get what you want, which, as you're pointing out, are multifaceted lives. And if you plan ahead for that and you make good choices and you put certain things at this, for example, the real focus, the shift over the last 30 years has been on this focus on careers as being the center of women's lives. And then men and children sort of, or husbands and children, sort of get fit in around that. And I'm saying if you reverse it and put marriage and motherhood at the center of your life, assuming that you want that, and try to fit those other things in around that, you're probably going to end up in a better situation.
Let's take another quick call here. Lane's calling from Brighton. Welcome to Radio Boston, Lane.
Hi, guys. Thanks for having me. I think this is a really interesting conversation, but I consider myself very liberal. I'm getting my master's degree, and when I say I'm getting my master's degree and I have someone, you know, that I'm in love with and I want to marry, oh, I hope you don't do that before you finish your master's degree. You can put your kids, you can put having kids, you know, later in life. And I feel guilty, I have to admit, saying that I would think about becoming engaged or having kids or getting married and putting off getting my master's degree because people look at me weird. Mm. They think, why would you ever do that? Why wouldn't you get your schooling and your career underway? Well, I'm going to be 35 or 40 by the time I get settled into my career.
Lane, I'm so sorry that I had to cut you off. We're running short on time. Thank you so much for your call and your perspective there, which, you know, as Suzanne has said and we've heard shared by a lot, the sort of conflict that people feel. Suzanne, we've just got a couple minutes left, and I want to ask you one last question.
Okay.
About, you know, how what Americans are feeling, American women in this day and age, because you write very eloquently in the book about sexual promiscuity and the problems, mm-hmm. and the pressures that young women feel there. But you also write that there's growing pushback, that, you know, a lot of young women are saying, no, I don't want to be sexually promiscuous. And also about marriage, you write that the fact is most Americans do want to get married, no matter what you say feminists are telling them to do. So I guess what I'm wondering is, if the numbers that you cite are there, that Americans are still independent thinkers and they have their own values and they want to be married, what are you still so afraid of from feminism?
Oh, I'm not afraid of feminism. I'm pointing out what's going on, and people want that and need that information so that they can begin to think differently about their lives. The fact that women want to be married, or Americans still want to be married, is a great thing. The problem is we have an issue with marriage in this country, and so there's a gap between what they're saying they want to do and the messages that they get from the culture.
Well, we had a lot of more callers who wanted to join this conversation. I'm sorry I couldn't get to you, but you can always leave your comments at our website, radioboston.org. Suzanne Venker, co-author along with Phyllis Schlafly of The Flip Side of Feminism, What Conservative Women Know and Men Can't Say. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
We'll be back after a short break. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty with Anthony Brooks. This is Radio Boston.